Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Sober Indians Wednesday Night Live. I'm Karen, and tonight we have Sally, and she's going to be taking us down her road to recovery. Hi, Sally. How are you doing?
Hi. I'm doing well.
Good. I wanted to start by asking you if you would mind just telling everybody a little bit about yourself before we get into your story.
Certainly. So, my name is Sally Finday. I'm an Ojibwe woman. My Ojibwe name is Ashikawebeek, and that's been interpreted to mean one who sits alone, and it's also been interpreted to mean one who crosses over. So I choose whichever I want to in different parts of my life. I grew up here in northern Minnesota, and I'm probably about only 7 miles from where I grew up. I'm on the north shore of Cass Lake, which is a lake in Minnesota that the Mississippi River flows through. There's also been some extreme weather up here in northern Minnesota. We have just had 42 below on Saturday morning. And when that happened, the lake's been frozen over for quite some time. But when that happened, my water in my house froze up. That's kind of a drag. And I'm still waiting on somebody to come out and get under there and do some mending on my heat tape pipe, things like that. So, I am a Native American woman who grew up in our family community. My family community is on our treaty land. Treaty land is land that still we as a family possess. My dad had 20 acres, and since his passing, he's handed that down to his children, and he had 5 children. Unfortunately, since my dad's passed, my brother has also passed, so now there's 4 daughters who still live here in the region. We don't live on our land. We actually some of us do. Two live on our allotment land, and 2 of us live on the lakeshore of Cass Lake, which is a beautiful place, in the Chippewa National Forest. Chippewa National Forest is probably maybe 45 by 45 miles, and the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe it's a reservation in north central Minnesota, and it encompasses my land, the Cass Lake, Lake Winnebogoche, or Winnebogoshish, and also the Chippewa National Forest. The Chippewa National Forest is held in trust for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe tribal citizens. And we still do hunting and gathering here in the forest. There's plenty to go on here. I've myself been actively engaged in recovering my religion. And I say that because when I was a youngster, I went to a school which is 20 miles from where I live. We got on the bus early. We were the first ones on and the last ones off, and that means me and my cousins. We went to the school in Black Dick, Minnesota, and there was very few other Indian students there. So it was quite an upbringing to grow up in a place where there weren't many people like you. You had to learn to get along. We dealt with racism. We dealt with an untrue history. I can remember the first time that I was in class and they were telling me that our people were brought here, that we came over a great bridge across the northern hemisphere way back in the day, and that I was appalled to hear it, because as a child I knew that, you know, our history wasn't that. We've been here, and we didn't come from Europe or China. We've been here as citizens of the Turtle Island, North America, since the beginning of time. So that was one thing that startled me right off the bat when I was a child. One of the other things that startled me was that fact that there used to be, when I was a child, which was in the 60s, there used to be a Wednesday, I believe, was the day that everybody, the whole school was shut down for an afternoon, and it was because the children had then could go to their church service, or probably it was. I don't know exactly. I never went. One of the things that was that I was participated, the way that I participated was I was the flag girl, the girl that took the flag and held it out so the students could cross the street safely to church and back from church. And at that time, I was really young, probably first grade maybe, and I asked my parents, why? Why don't we have a religion? Why don't we have our own religion? And my dad just basically just said, you know, we do have our own religion. But, you know, I think I asked if I could go to the church that these other non-Native children were going to. And so he said, no, we have our own religion, and no, you're not going to participate in theirs. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I went along my merry way that year, and I never really thought too much about it after that, except from time to time when I was growing up and I knew that the history books were saying some pretty negative things about Native American people. They were saying things like, well, you know how Native people are so stupid that when we came here, the Europeans, they actually traded the island of Manhattan for beads. This was in our history book back then. And I thought, wow, geez, that sounds really stupid. And I'm a Native American. They're trying to make me feel like I'm stupid, too. But I know I'm not stupid. I'm one of the smartest kids in the class. So as it turned out, I actually left the school early. I was in the 11th grade when I left. It just got to be such a downer. Downer for me because I'm a Native American kid and I've experienced racism and I've, you know, challenged that and lived within the environment of a non-Native school with only my cousins as other people of color for me who were like me. So I endured that, and at 11th grade I said, you know what, I'm done with this. I am moving on and I'm going to find my own way. I'm bored stiff too, bored stiff with whatever was being taught at the time and, you know, the feeling that I was not a part of the system, not a part of anything. I just felt like, geez, this isn't my school. This isn't where I belong. So I went about my way, and I moved to the Twin Cities, which is about 250 miles south of where I grew up. And if you know the state of Minnesota, that's also down along the Mississippi River. And currently I live along the Mississippi River, and the river runs through Cass Lake, Minnesota. So as I went along on my journey, I remember I had my first child when I was 21 with a non-Native man. Probably I sought out a non-Native man because I felt comfortable for me because there were no other Native kids in my school except my cousins. And we had a child, my son, who was born when I was 21. You know, at the time I felt like I was really, I didn't have my family because I lived in the Twin Cities. I didn't have them as support oftentimes. But then 3 years later we had my daughter. We also bought our first home. We had our first brand new car. We were, you know, to me, I was thinking, geez, this is living the life, you know. This is the all-American life at that time, which was to have, you know, two kids and own your own home. And one day I was looking at my hand and I thought, geez, you know what? I'm a Native American woman. And I don't have the slightest idea what that means. So from that point on, I started researching our history, our true history, our Native American history, the treaties, the laws, the history of the Europeans who came to this country. And, you know, they made it sound like, you know, they had all these nice agreements and this and that with the Indian people. But in fact, they did. They came here and they demolished a culture of people. They did horrible things to the Indian people of this land, to the people out on the East Coast, to the people that are here in Minnesota. And this happened in my Minnesota is only like 200 years old, so, or maybe 150. Anyway, it's been a journey that's brought me to many, many different places. I remember when I was in my, when I first discovered that I was a Native American woman, I looked at my hand and said, "That's, I'm a Native, what does that mean?" I went on a journey and I followed the Lakota in the metro area of the Twin Cities, and that's because there was really hush-hush about the religious practices of Ojibwe people. And so the Lakota were more open with their ceremonies and their religion. And I participated with the Lakota people in the Sundance. I had my first, what do we call that, vision quest on Bear Butte. One of our leaders that we had at the time who was leading us at in our sweat lodge ceremony every week. We had sweat lodge ceremony either on Friday night or Saturday night. And as a young person, as a sober person at that time, I really enjoyed the fact that I could gather with people, other Indian people, at a sweat lodge on a Friday night or Saturday night. And those are the nights when, you know, usually people, you know, young people like me were out, you know, in the bars or, you know, doing other activities. In fact, you know, I gave up drinking and using drugs when, geez, it must have been, my daughter must have been about six. I was probably in my upper 28, 29 years old. So what happened after that was I kept going to the sweat lodge as I lived there in the Twin Cities and learned about the Lakota ways. Oftentimes, though, I often felt like, you know, this is really good to learn the Lakota way, but they don't, their values didn't fit with what I was brought up with as an Ojibwe. So I think, and I brought my children there too. My children have all experienced the sweat lodge. They've experienced the Sundance. They are pretty knowledgeable about our culture because of the fact that, you know, I was learning my culture and religion as I went along. I was probably in my early 30s when I finally encountered a friend who, she asked me if I would go to a hidden society called the Three Fires. And it was a place where they had Midewewin ceremony. And I was like, oh, I was ecstatic to go with her. We went, and I noticed when I first got there that this just seemed like my world. You go to the Lakota ceremonies, they're pretty serious, you know. There's women, you know, doing all the cooking. They're serving everybody, you know, and they're pretty much, you know, in the background. And when I got there to the Three Fires Society, the Midewewin there, it was... there was a lot of laughter. The women actually were being served. The men were serving the women, cooking the meals and serving the women within the ceremonies, within the ceremonial lodge, which I thought was, wow, that's totally what I'm used to. Not that my father did that, but, you know, my mother and father had a respectful relationship. And she was always the head of the household as far as finances go and was always considered. And I ended up meeting my husband there at the midday ceremony that very same weekend. And he was from Canada, and he spoke the Ojibwe language. He was, at the time, a up-and-coming traditional healer. At first I was kind of thinking, wow, you know, that's different, you know, that's, what is this? You know, I was unfamiliar with it. But as we journeyed together in our marriage, I realized that, you know, this man has a lot of special qualities. And yes, he is human, you know, and he's got some things that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily agree with, you know, with raising children. He's got different ideals than I do, different mechanisms for, you know, just raising children. That was our downfall, I think, was trying to blend our families when we really weren't agreeing as parents on what was the proper way. Because, you know, he was raised differently than I was, you know, like a lot of people, a lot of families at the time. And I'll get on to that in a little bit. So we had moved to my family's land, on our treaty land, mostly because I wanted to go back to college. And I did. We moved back up here. I bought a mobile home at a garage sale for $850. It was a 3-bedroom mobile home, nice shape. Had a little issues, you know, but I hauled it over to my dad's land. And then with my sister and brother-in-law, who are carpenters, you know, hired them to fix it up, patch the floors and, you know, the walls, better insulate it. We have severe weather up here in the wintertime. So the first 6 months that we lived in our home, we lived there without running water. And it was because the Bureau of Indian Affairs was going to install water, but they had a backlog. And I thought I had put my application in early enough. But anyway, as it turned out, I was also going to college at the time, but I was sick. One day I went to my mother's and I said, you know what, I don't feel good. And she said, well, lay down on the couch for a while. And I laid down on the couch. And then I got up and I went to the bathroom and I was like, ugh, horrified. What looked like a lot of blood. And I came out and told her, and she goes, you better get to the doctor. So I went to the doctor, the Indian Health Service clinic here in the community, and they gave me some tests. My tests were, take this home, and I want you to put your stool on it, and then bring it back to us. And I thought, well, they couldn't figure out. They gave me some antibiotics because they figured I had salmonella or something like that. And I brought that back, and they called me back maybe a week later and said, we're sorry, but, you know, somebody put your sample in the refrigerator and it froze, so can you do it for us again? And I was, like, horrified. I thought, oh, my God, are you kidding me? I'm dying. Nobody's telling me what's going on with me. You know, you're guessing. You're only guessing what it possibly could be. You're testing me because you really don't know exactly what it is. So at that same time, a fellow from Canada came here, and he was doing a shake pin ceremony. That's a ceremony that I've never experienced. I've heard about it from my father, and I'll tell you some stories about him that have, you know, influenced my visions as an adult and being a Native American woman and experiencing the Native American way. Well, anyway, we had went to the ceremony, and I was the English-speaking person. My husband was the Ojibwe speaker. So the man within the tent, which is a little tent, only about probably 3 feet by 3 feet, a circular, open-ended, like a teepee, but not formed in the middle, just kind of standing up sticks on a platform. And it was at a school, the Bugna Nagishik school, the tribal school here. It was in the backyard there. And I was sick at the time. I had lost a lot of weight. I was down to probably 110 pounds. And I'm nearly 5'7". It was kind of devastating for me. I was thinking I was going to die. I had constant pain in my stomach. Whenever I'd eat, I couldn't keep food down. And if I kept it down, it hurt so much to process it. And all this time, you know, the doctors at the Indian Health Service are just kind of testing me and trying to figure out what exactly is wrong with me and not really giving me an absolute answer. So when we went to the ceremony that night, I talked to my husband and I said to him, I said, do you think it would be okay for me to ask what's wrong with me? Am I going to die? He said, well, yeah, of course it would be. I said, I don't even have a gift. It didn't even cross my mind that I should ask for help at this time. He goes, well, you know what? The guy probably wouldn't mind using some money. So if you have any money, you know, give him some money. Offer him tobacco. So, you know what? I went and offered the gentleman some tobacco. His name was Ron Gieschik. What an incredible man. He was probably in his 60s at the time. Me and my husband were in our early 30s. And he said to me, all right, he said, he recognized, you know, that, you know, the tobacco. And he, when he did the ceremony, he said, it was dark at the time. I sat down on the ground and he said, hold on to the stick of the tent. And so I did. I grabbed onto the stick of the tent and I was really praying intently, please, God, save me, or whoever, spirits, tell him what's wrong with me. Find out what's wrong with me. I don't want to die. And at the end of the ceremony, he talked to all the people. And then he talked to me and he said, you know, what's going on with you is you have intestinal infection. And there's a plant that's native here to it's probably in your backyard. We'll look for it tomorrow. So the next day we looked for it. It was fireweed. we brewed up some tea, and he said, drink this tea for a month, 3 cups a day. So I did. And you know what? I was healed, miraculously healed from intestinal infection. That, to me, solidified my belief that, you know, our way of life, our spirituality, even the sweat lodges that we went to together, you know, the things that I've seen, when you open your mind and your spirit to see the world, that's another realm that's right, probably right, it's invisible to the people who don't recognize it. It's invisible, the feeling of, and the seeing of human beings who are passed on, the feeling of seeing a large white cat used to come into my bedroom. When I lived in the city, it was there, and I just kind of was like, wow, what was that? You know, and not really recognizing it as being a spirit helper. But I've also seen it here in the sweat lodge. I've seen, I thought it was my friend Sharon who was sitting next to me in the lodge, and we get out during the open door, you know, everybody gets out. It was fall time, and I remember seeing this woman walking up from the swampy area, and she came up walking slowly, and I could see her shadow in the moonlight, and I thought, wow, that must be Sharon. I wonder what she's doing down there. And then she came, and we get back in, and I looked at Sharon, and Sharon's hair is curly, and I thought, there is no way that could be Sharon. And sure enough, when I thought about it again, I thought, you know what, that woman looked more like my grandmother, my dad's mother, coming up to the sweat, you know, to join us in the ceremony. It's just all so beautiful. You know, everything that I experienced with our way of life and the ceremonies and the healing that goes on, our people and the realm that we all have, every person, no matter what color you are, have the capacity to live with the spirits, to journey that way. It doesn't matter if you're black, white, Asian, Indian, doesn't matter. Everybody has the capacity to reach and embrace the spiritual world that's with us every day. That the people that have gone on, that they still watch over us. When we pray and ask for help, those people are there. They're helping us. When your spirit helpers are there, you know, for me, I have the, my mother's side, our spirit helper is the clan. It's our clan. Our clan is the Makua, and on my mother's side, the bear. And on my father's side is the Ogeesh Kamanasi, and that is a bird, a kingfisher bird that was also recognized as the one of the last clans recognized by the Ojibwe Nation, probably in the 1800s, was the Ogeesh Kamanasi. And that clan was recognized because that family, and that's my family, actually one of my ancestors, married a Dakota person. So the Ojibwe people that were moving into the area were embracing the Dakotas as well, the Dakota people that lived here. And they embraced us, and we had we had family, marriages, and things like that, and that's where we got the newest clan to the Ojibwe Nation, the Kingfisher. So that's a little bit about how my recovery was, and how my embracing of culture and family brought me many, many different experiences. My father was, when he died 26 years ago now. But before his passing, I spent lots of time with him because I lived in the city, and I'd come up every Friday, and he would talk. We would sit and talk and visit. And one of the things that he told me during that time was, you know, he said, I've taught you a lot of things in your life, he said. But he said, I don't think that I've taught you enough about judging people, being humble. He said, you know, I think that's a lesson that you probably are going to learn, you know, but I'm going to tell you that, you know, you have to be humble. You can't be judgmental of people. You'll learn it. You'll get it. My father passed on, but he also talked a lot about his world at the time. You know, as kids, we never really talked to our parents. We never did at that time. We were just having a jolly good time, me and my cousins, playing outside all summer long and, you know, coming in and eating our meals with our families. My father never told us much other than say to us, here's some tobacco when it's storming really hard, and we're all kind of afraid of tornadoes and thunder and lightning. And he said, here's some tobacco. Go put it out by the tree out there. And we'd say, well, why? Just go do it. He said, that's for the spirits. That's for them to come and help and protect us. And that's what he would say. When people came to visit at my home, my mom and dad's home, mom always served up tea. Whatever food we had, we always offered it. And, you know, my dad would tell stories about when he was a child and when he went to midday ceremony. When he went, he said they used to have large gatherings of all kinds of people would come. And he told stories about what happened there. And he said, you know, one night he said they're all sitting around listening. And, you know, they're kids. They're supposed to be in bed and sleeping. But there's a camp where they were. And they were all listening. And he said he saw that these medicine people that came there from different parts of the country, from Canada, from other parts of the country, that they were all showing each other some of the things that they could do. And he said that one of them, he remembers quite because it was surprising, he said. It was so surprising. But this man actually made dolls get up and dance without, you know, just through the power of his prayer or his ceremony. I'm not really sure. He just said it was frightening, too, as a child. And he remembers that the shake tent ceremony was quite an experience. He said, you know, all the kids were told, stay away from there. Don't play there. And my father was... and his buddies would go over there. And then one of them actually went in. And when he came back out, he stuttered for the rest of his life. He literally was so frightened of what he saw and heard in there that it just made him stutter for the rest of his life. And these are some of the things that my dad passed on to us. But, you know, as children, we never really paid attention. And I think one of the worst things that ever happened was the fact that I never paid attention to who my family are. Because what happened here with us Ojibwe is that four generations ago, the BIA, the agents who were here overseeing, you know, the reservation, the people that were here, they said one day, come and everybody's going to get an English name, which is really sad. I mean, it's fine, because my name is Fine Day. But, and I used to think this, I never really put two and two together because my Uncle George was a Ojibwe language teacher. He taught at the University of Duluth. He also taught at Bemidji State University here in this region. And he had always, they were such fun loving, my uncles were fun loving characters, just characters, always laughing and telling stories. He'd always say, he said, you know how we got our name? And that we'd be like, well, how did we get our name? And he said, well, when the BIA agent came and they said to us, you got a choice between two names. Do you want Muzumu or do you want Fine Day? And then we're like, well, what does Muzumu mean? And he goes, Muzumu means moose dung. And I'm like, what? That's crazy. I used to think as a young person, I thought, that's a funny story. And then when I grew up to be an adult, I realized that my great-great-grandfather was Chief Muzumu. That was his name. And I'm like, gosh, how could he have... You know, he was so funny at telling the story. He never said, that's the reality. This is real. He just told the story and we all laughed and thought it was funny. But, yeah, so those are some of the things that, you know, being an Ojibwe woman that I've learned and experienced in my lifetime. And I'm very happy to have found my religion, to recover my spirituality, to realize who I am as an Indian woman, an Ojibwe woman, and to live up to my name. It's been an experience. I'm very happy to share it today.
Did you have any questions?
I'm fascinated. Well,
it's cool,
I'm sitting here thinking, and I'm just completely, totally fascinated with your story. Gosh, I don't know. And normally I have questions.
Oh, I have plenty of stories.
Is there anything else?
No, I think I'm pretty confident that that's a pretty good retelling of who I am and how I came to be and some of the stories along the way. And quite an amazing journey. And I'm comfortable today in my life and in who I am in my own skin. And I also do a lot of work today as in my own community. I'm a MIS. I work for the MIS IT division for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and I started with them in 2012. And I came to them as a person who's a grant writer, or is able to write for grants, and we wrote for a grant, and then they hired me as the manager for their new telecommunications company. And between 2012 and 2015, I learned the telecommunications industry. And I remember during those times just thinking, oh, my gosh, how am I going to – I'm so afraid of this because, you know, it's something I've never learned. And I'm like, oh, and one night I had a dream, and I dreamed all the telecommunications industry is – it's all about connections. That's it. Fiber connections, wireless connections, telephone connections. You know, that's all it is. Everything is just jargon. The rest is jargon. They got a whole world of jargon, 5G. That means that's the fifth generation phone or the fifth generation broadband that's capable with this type of phone. That's all that means, fifth generation. There's just so much. So today I work for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe in the capacity of a grant writer specialist in IT. And I wrote a grant recently because we're attempting to put fiber to the tower. Because the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, last year I secured for the tribe 2.5 megahertz spectrum. When I got into the industry, I was really saddened to learn that the federal government had at some point just taken the airspace above our tribe and not even told us about it, and they sold it. They sold it in auction to all these companies in the United States so that, you know, they could get cell phone service here or radio service here or whatever. The Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe has some quite interesting and smart people here that work in the IT division. And they have been using, since 1999, the 3 spectrum, was called 3.65 spectrum. They were using it to send signals. They would get one service. You know, you got to understand the reservation I live on. It's a 60 by 60 mile area. There's a telephone service over on the east side that serves the east side. There's a couple down south that serve the south side. There's one in the west that serves the west side. And north is the mostly the Chippewa National Forest. So we have all these companies that are charging us astronomical bills because every time you move an office, you've got to take that telephone jack and put it somewhere else in that office, or take it out of there and put it somewhere else. Well, they were charging us through the roof for that. So in 1999, our IT division said, well, let's take that one service and then we'll just do the in-house stuff. So if somebody's moving their office space and they want the jack moved from that wall to that wall, we'll go move it for them. Our IT division would. And that's how they grew and developed. And then they said, well, you know what? We don't need the service to provide us telephone service. Let's bring that to the air. So since 1999, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe has been using the spectrum, this free spectrum, to reproduce telephone and broadband and send it through the air to 33 buildings in tribal buildings and offices in the city of Cass Lake and some outlying communities as well. So today I wrote a grant. Yesterday I wrote a grant. Today I participated in a conference call. I'm also on several boards. One of the boards that really brings great joy to my heart is the Lady Slipper Scenic Byway Board, which is a board that has been in existence for about 15 years. And what it does is it recently took the highway that's going from the Highway 2, which is an interstate highway, to Black Duck, has recently been, in the last 15 years, torn up and redone. But all along the highway are lady slippers, which are our state flower in Minnesota. The lady slipper is a beautiful flower. It looks like a slipper. It's pink, and sometimes it's yellow. But it grows in such a condition that, you know, it just doesn't grow everywhere. It's got to be a perfect condition for it to grow. So what the Lady Slipper Scenic Byway Board did was they gathered funds and they hired people to come in, Army Corps of Engineers, some of the CCC camp leftovers, some youth groups to come in and pick up those lady slippers and transplant them in a safe place in the Chippewa National Forest. And then when the highway was done, it was done 7 miles at a time. It's a 21-mile run. when the Waiwi was done, then they brought the plants back and put them back where the where they were. So that's one of the my boards that I sit on. That's, you know, very, it reaches my heart and soul because I grew up here along this highway. And another board I sit on is I'm a commissioner for the state of Minnesota's Minnesota Mississippi River Parkway Commission. And what that commission does is we watch over the river water, the Mississippi River, from the headwaters in Itasca State Park over just east of here, about 60 miles. And we watch that river come through our state of Minnesota. And, you know, the mission is to promote tourism, to promote economic development along the river, but also to protect and preserve the river. So that, to me, speaks to my heart, to be able to protect and preserve the river, because I live here in the Chippewa National Forest, and the Mississippi River runs right through the lake out in my, on my lake shore. So I was in a meeting today about that. But, so I also am involved in the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe. The Minnesota Chippewa Tribe is an organization that's kind of the umbrella organization, the fiscal organization for the early development in, I think it was 1934 when the Constitution was developed. And it was when all the government was still trying to take away the land from the local people. So we banded together, because that's what we do as Ojibwe people. We have, in our history, we have banded together. We have alliances with lots of people through our movement. Because we originally started on the East Coast. We are part of the Onondaga Nation, and we're part of the Six Nations. But we're a group of people that, you know, probably way back then said, you know what, we're going to move east, we're going to go west, we're going to move west. And we followed the riverway of the Lake Erie, and all the way over here to Lake Superior is where we landed and where we stayed here in Minnesota, central Minnesota. And so the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe is a umbrella organization for six tribes in Minnesota. The six tribes are, out west is White Earth. They have 20,000 members. Leech Lake is next. We're in central Minnesota, and we have 10,000 members. And then we go to Mille Lacs, Fond du Lac is not. Net Lake, and then north to Grand Portage. So those are the six Ojibwe tribes that banded together under the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe in 1934 and in trying to establish space for us as a community of people. And there's another Ojibwe nation north of us called Red Lake Nation, and they decided they didn't want anything to do with Public Law 280. They didn't care about that. We're just going to keep to ourselves, and we're going to do what we've always done, which is just, you know, solidify as a group that owns the land as one. And because we joined the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, a lot of our citizens between the early 1900s lost their land through swindle and whatever. People didn't understand the value of the land. We have always had our land. You know, we never thought we'd have to, you know, pay to live on it or pay somebody to take care of the, you know, the trails or whatever. But anyway, so that's the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe. We have a constitution that just is unsuitable. It tells nothing of who we are as people. It doesn't say anything about why we are aligned. As a people, our alliances, you know, in the beginning, we were a part of the Six Nations. And then when we moved out here to Michigan, we had a stop in Michigan, and we aligned ourselves at that time with the Potawatomi. And then since then, we went to Madeline Island, which is a beautiful island. And we harbored ourselves there for 300 years, I believe. And then we were finally into central Minnesota, and then we started trading with the French. We're good traders. We're pretty good about a lot of different things. But as we came into the central Minnesota, then we were dispersed, you know, to White Earth and to, you know, the Leech Lake, Fond du Lac, Grand Portage. We were all dispersed in different areas. And so that's where I'm one person on a group of 60 delegates who are working to change that constitution to make it more solid for us as a nation, and also to also more tightly bind ourselves together, but also recognize the fact that we are six nations and we are all different, and we need to recognize that we can't be the same. We can't just be these six nations run by all the same rules. It just doesn't work. So we're working on that now, and it's quite exciting. So I keep myself busy with my office job and my different boards and things like that, and ceremony. I don't do a lot of ceremonies today. If people ask me for a sweat lodge, I'll do that. Me and my husband, who was a medicine man, we had revived the Midday Lodge here at Leech Lake, because it was at one time my family, the Finde family, the Muzumu family, who had been the keepers of the lodge here at Leech Lake. So we did that, and I'm still hopeful that soon we'll. I've been told by a spiritual leader here at Leech Lake that the person who's going to lead this group, lead the Midday Lodge, is a person that's coming, and that he's coming from far away. So I'm like, that's interesting. So I'm still waiting for that leader. In the meantime, we do what we can to preserve our culture, to keep that alive. You know, I do a ceremony every fall and every springtime to open the lodge, and then every fall to close the lodge. And recently, I've been gifted with a drum and been told that this drum is for the women and that we have to start singing. So I just sang with it beginning of January this year. It's been in my home since last fall. And I just kind of set it in my bedroom, and I kind of look at it from time to time and wonder, what am I going to do with this and how am I going to do that? And then one, my daughter's friend came and visited here, and he said, I'm a singer. I know songs. I know a woman's song. And he sang the song, and I said, oh, my gosh, I've got to have that. Would you teach me, or do you mind if I record it so I can teach myself? So I recorded that song. I gave him tobacco and a gift for his song, for his leaving that song with me. We sang for a couple hours, and I hadn't sang in a long time, and it was just so, just to sing a spiritual song just brought my heart to my throat. You know how that you get that lump in your throat? That's what I felt like that day. And then since then I've kind of realized that, you know what, that's the next journey I'm on. I'm going to have to bring that drum alive and bring some women here to sing, and we're going to sing, and we're going to sing here in our lands first, and then who knows where we're going to go with it. But that's another step.
That is a beautiful story. I've thoroughly enjoyed everything that you have talked about, and I've learned stuff. And I think I'm amazed by your story, and I appreciate you coming on and sharing it with me. I really do, and everybody else too.
Wonderful, wonderful. Miigwech is what we say for thank you. Miigwech.
Very well.
The Potawatomi,
very well,
who are in Oklahoma, actually say the same thing, Miigwech. A lot of our language is the same.
Oh, wow.
But, that's the way it goes, I guess.
Yeah.
So, did you have any other questions? Or would you like to hear some more stories?
You can tell some more stories, because I'm totally fascinated by listening to your stories.
Okay, I'm going to tell you about the Moon Daughters. It was an organization that me and some women started. And we started it because, you know, what happens oftentimes is women are trying to keep their balance. They're trying to remain balanced. We're trying to keep our family well. We're trying to keep our jobs in the community. We're trying to keep our job that pays us to support our families. And it's hard because there's so many people that are just back there beating you down. Sometimes it just feels like, when are you going to stop? You know, and just leave us alone. We're just trying to be women. We're women leaders in our community. Just let us be. So we went to this gentleman who's our spiritual leader here in this community, and he had a sweat for us. He didn't come in with us, but we had a sweat. I led the lodge, and sweat lodge, it's a purification ceremony where we have a dwelling that we go into, and we put hot rocks into a, well, we heat up rocks so they're really hot, and then we bring them in. And for me, I usually bring in 7 at a time and just do 4 doors, not large rocks. You know, we don't want to hurt our we're gentle with our ceremonies for women. So we had this ceremony, and he said to us, he gave us each something different that we had to do. And for me, he said, I want you to go out and gather 4 rocks, different colors, from 4 different places. And I want you to bring them back to the next time we gather together, the women that we, there was 4 women. And I thought, wow, that is amazing, because you know what? Those 4 rocks are already part of my sacred bundle. They're the rocks that way back in the day I collected for my own sacred bundle and my own altar. And that brings me back to a memory of when my father was dying. You know, I was so immature at the time and so new on my journey. I was still practicing the Dakota ways. And my father was dying, and I was up here a lot, and I built a sweat lodge in our backyard. And we took him to Canada. And, you know, my father had never been experienced. He had never experienced any ceremonies outside of what he grew up as a child and what he was told to hide, because, you know, it was against the law for us Indian people to practice our religion. So he never had that experience. So we took him to a traditional healer in Canada, and she was a woman. And she brought him into a sweat lodge. We went in with him, me and my mom, my sisters. I don't think my brother was there. I don't recall him being there. But then we stayed overnight, and then we came back, and then she came to visit him once at his home, and my sweat lodge was in the backyard. She came over to me, and she said, so do you know that your door is wrong? It's the opposite direction. And I'm like, really? What do you mean? She goes, well, the Ojibwe people, our door is always opening to the east, and mine was to the west, because that's the Lakota-Dakota way. And I told her that. And she goes, and by the way, who gave you the authority to do this, to put this lodge here, to put it up and to run ceremony here? And I said, well, gee, Creator gave me this direction. The Creator, can you believe that? I said, who gave you your authority? And she was talking about how many teachers she had and this and that and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, gee, that's really good for you. I said, but, you know, for me, my guidance comes directly from the Creator. I don't ask anybody to tell me what to do, period. I do it because, I teach this, too, as a lesson to young people who are saying, I'm hearing these voices, or I really feel compelled to do this. And I'm just like, well, do it, because you know what? If people are asking you or seeking you out for guidance, you just need to do it. Because that's the Creator sending a message to you through those people to do it. Just teach. Be yourself. Do well for your community. So, I did continue that. And then I had a dream. I was still living in the city, and I had a dream one night that I was doing a ceremony. It was, and the man was laying on the bed, and I was like, there was this half circle of people around him. And I'm like, wow, that's different. So anyway, I offered my dad a ceremony, a healing ceremony, and he said, yeah, you can do that for me. And so we were in his bedroom, and believe it or not, the people that were sitting around that bed were my family, my sisters, my brother, my mother. And I was so insecure in my way at the time. I had my sister, you know, I gave her a list of all the spirits that I wanted to ask to come and help us. And I said, and if I miss anything, will you just look at that list and tell me, you know, just say it out loud. But, it just brings tears to my eyes. Mm-hmm. Thinking about that, yes, and yes, remembering that ceremony and the people that were there, because I had dreamed it before it even happened, the people were my family. It was just a miracle. He died at that year of cancer. Still a journey for me. And, you know, the biggest experience in my whole entire life about spirits and understanding the spirit world and how we function here in our realm, here on Earth, in these physical bodies, was when my dad passed away. We were by his bed for days. He put himself in a hospice because he didn't want to die at home because he was afraid my mother would be afraid to live there. And she might have been. She was a Christian. Oh. She was raised in the Christian way, the Catholic religion. So he didn't want her to be afraid to live there. So he moved out and moved into a hospice place, and we'd visit him there. And then we'd visit him, and he'd always say to us, he'd say, gee, today I went and visited some friends from, you know, Oak Point. And he said, and I went over there, and there was nobody that I recognized. My friend wasn't even there, but these people, I don't know who they were. And when I'm like, wow. Then he'd say, Sally, he said, I was so angry with you. I said, why? He goes, I told you, and me and Uncle George came to pick you up, and my Uncle George had passed on before my dad. And he said, me and Uncle George came to pick you up in a flying car, and we took you over to Cutfoot Sioux, and that's where my great-great-grandfather, that was where he lived. Cutfoot Sioux is the name of the place. And he said, we took you over there, and he says, and then you got out of the car, and I said, Sally, those shorts are way too short. And I'm like, Dad, that's what he had. And I thought, you know what, we were talking about this, you know, between ourselves, my family and my mother. And we said, you know, Dad's journeying every day. What he tells us is not because he's high on the drugs that they're giving him. He's doing this. He's physically leaving that place. His spirit is leaving him. He's visiting his people. That's what he's doing. All this stuff is true. It was for all of us. It was an eye-opener because none of us had experienced that world. The way of life of the Ojibwe and our beliefs. So it was really quite inspiring, but also it was also part of the journey and part of the experience and part of why I tell people that, you know, whatever way you learn is a good way. And that's what a lot of people who are true spiritual leaders will tell you. There's always different ways. Do you think that everybody had the same way? That's only because the church teaches people that there's only one way. For us, it's all different. It can be different from my village to your village. You know, it's just the way we are. And so that's a teaching in itself. So when somebody tells you, oh, you're doing that the wrong way, you know, it's like, well, that's the way I was taught. So you can keep that thought to yourself because that's who we are as people. We are Ojibwe people. We are. We share our values. We share our way. And now that it's not against the law, you know, I do it as often as I can. I educate wherever I go, try to help other people, other cultures, to understand who we are as people and why we're here. And what is our real purpose in this whole world here as Ojibwe people, as Indian people on our Mother Earth. It is our sole purpose to care for our mother. So all the people that are fighting against these people who are putting in these pipelines and extracting our mother's blood from her and using it, shipping it to other countries. That's horrible for us to believe that's going on. And I commend all the people that are protesting, all the people that have given up parts of their lives. And many people have been seriously damaged, you know, by the government's troops that have come in to try to prevent them from protecting our mother. Quite an eye-opener when you think about it like that. And I speak to my friends that, all my friends, and I say that because I do have quite a bit of non-Native friends, and I always tell them the truth is, it's our journey. We're all going to learn here, probably pretty sooner than later, because the damage is evident now, what we're doing to our mother. I said, how could you do that to your mother when she's the one who gives you everything, everything? Look out at your car, that car sitting in the driveway. That's our mother. Every piece on there. Nothing came from anywhere else but our mother. You don't see any foreign universal products here, you know, from the universe. Nothing. It's all from our mother. The steel, the oil, the whatever, the house we live in, the wood we use, the everything, the fire that keeps us warm in the wintertime. All of it is from our mother. We have to respect her. We have to somehow engage many people to understand that. You know, it's not about the money. That money is nothing. It's going to mean nothing when you don't have food for your people. You don't have water to survive. you're not going to need that money. You're going to need our mother. You're going to need the water. You're going to need the air. You're going to need the fire. That's our purpose. Let's protect our mother.
Wow. Beautifully said. Very, very beautifully said. And I agree with you 100%.
Right.
I see a lot of stuff, too, and it bothers me. And I think that people need to open their eyes and actually start listening versus what a lot do. And I wanted to thank you for coming on tonight. It has been a very informative show, and hopefully at another date, if you want to, I'll have you come back on and we can talk some more if you like.
I've really
enjoyed listening to you. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm honored that you came on tonight. Very much so. I wanted to tell everybody thank you for coming on and joining us tonight and listening. I hope you take something from tonight's show. I know I have. And I wanted to say good night and thank you once again for coming on.
Thank you.